KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Inner Sunset.
Outer Sunset.
North Beach.
Mill Valley.
Knob Hill.
Coming up, when the next big earthquake hits, what would you do with a few seconds of warning?
Stop the trains, take the knife out of the person being operated on.
California's expanding earthquake early warning system. Then a new movie out this week dramatizes the legend of Bruce Lee. We'll hear the backstory of the martial artist's formative years here in the Bay Area.
Some people know this. Bruce Lee was a champion cha-cha dancer.
And from San Quentin Radio, we'll hear from incarcerated men who found their calling as barbers for fellow inmates.
Usually when I'm out there cutting hair, everybody's get a crowd standing around over there watching and talking.
Starting the conversation today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. 3 years ago, a 6.0 earthquake rattled the Bay Area. Napa Valley was hit the hardest. 200 people were injured, one person died, and the total financial damage in the area was almost $1 billion.
Apocalyptic, that may be the best word to describe the scene behind me. Would you look at these mobile homes or what's left of them? They were simply incinerated when all of
it was the largest earthquake in the Bay Area since the 1989 Loma Prieta quake. And it was the first time an experimental early warning system called Shake Alert notified researchers of a major quake before the shaking actually arrived. If researchers secure enough funding, we may have more time to duck, cover, and hold on before the next one. KALW's Angela Johnston has more on the expanding network of earthquake early warning sensors.
Barbara Hornsby is a night owl, so she was awake at 3:20 a.m. when her mobile home started violently shaking side to side.
So I was sitting at a table, reading late. I had just enough moment before I kind of went into shock that I thought, earthquake.
Her husband, Howard, was asleep in the next room.
It started with a really loud crack, kind of almost as if somebody shot a gun next to you. But there was movement, too, so you knew that wasn't what it was.
Howard jolted out of bed, and he heard Barbara calling for help.
The bookcase that was 3 feet away from me, 6-foot-tall bookcase, fell over on me. And this was one time when it really paid off to have a very inexpensive bookcase.
Paperback books and little copper sculptures flew off the shelves.
One giant thump. I said, I can't get out. I'm trapped. Help.
Howard stumbled around in the darkness, feeling his way toward Barbara.
The floors were separated at a large angle, and there was like a 3-foot gap, and I could have stepped into that.
He lifted the bookcase off her legs, and they made their way toward voices outside.
It was pitch dark, no power or anything, except for flames I could see through the window.
The earthquake ruptured the gas lines that lay underneath the mobile home park. Her neighbor's home was on fire. 4 homes burned to the ground that night. The Hornsbys were lucky. The fire didn't reach their mobile home, but the quake broke almost all of their support beams and damaged the structure beyond repair. They decided to buy a new one 2 blocks away.
Everyone was just so grateful that we were all alive and well and not injured. And so together, having experienced it all together.
Some of the damage was inevitable, but the fires and Barbara's near miss with the bookcase may have been prevented with even a few seconds of warning. But earthquake experts, they did get a little bit of a heads up. In the Napa quake, a network of sensor stations alerted researchers at Berkeley 5 seconds before people felt the shaking. The Department of Emergency Management in San Francisco, which tests the system, they got a 10-second warning. Right now, there are about 600 stations sprinkled across California, with the majority in the Bay Area. But more stations means potentially faster and more accurate warnings. UC Berkeley and USGS engineers are installing one right now in Willits, a couple hours north of the Hornsby's mobile home park. It's one of about 40 they're building across the state in the next 2 years. An earthquake sensor looks like a big black top hat. It's placed deep inside a concrete vault with another smaller hockey puck size sensor.
We like to call it a snake pit because oftentimes when we uncover everything, we find all kinds of critters down there.
Jonah Merritt leads the team of engineers installing these stations across the state. Today, they're digging trenches and pounding copper rods into the soil to ground all the electronics. Then they'll wire the sensors to a big solar panel that'll power the station. Here's how it'll work when it's all finished.
We are recording 6 channels of ground motion, and we will pick up earthquakes, both strong and tiny earthquakes, and those earthquakes, that data will be digitized in a in the simplest form. It is a computer, and we ship that data over the internet to our servers in Berkeley.
If a minimum of 4 stations record movement, that means it's not just a cow walking by, and it's actually an earthquake. In a matter of seconds, a computer will send out an alert to police stations, emergency services, and researchers hope in the future, everyone's phones.
So I imagine this on the one hand, this is us telling people like you, shaking is coming, drop cover and hold on, because that's what you need to do.
That's Peggy Helweg. She works with Jonah Merritt at the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory. She says for the general public, just thinking about what you'll do if you get an alert is one benefit of having an early warning system. But where those extra seconds could really count is with automatic systems.
What can a computer do that, of course, would take me a long time to decide to do, but the computer can shut it down quickly or make it safe or whatever somebody decides. This is a good thing to have on, off, when the earthquake shaking starts.
Like opening fire station doors, starting the generator, or programming an elevator to stop at the nearest floor.
Stop the trains, take the knife out of the person being operated on, maybe shut down the gas.
All before the shaking even starts.
Major earthquake of magnitude 7.9 hitting Japan. The meteorological issue.
In the 2011 Fukushima earthquake, Japan's advanced early warning system alerted residents on the coast 10 to 30 seconds before they felt tremors. People in Tokyo heard alerts on cell phones, computers, and TV a minute before shaking started. Semiconductor factory shut off equipment before it leaked chemicals. And 15 seconds before the quake hit, bullet trains received an automatic stop signal. UC Berkeley and USGS have already partnered with BART. Trains will automatically slow when they get a warning. And they've contacted some hospitals and gas companies to suggest that this may be a good thing to start thinking about.
And of course, the more stations we have, the more quickly we can detect the earthquake. And the quicker our data loggers send the data in, the main weakness is that we don't have enough network, enough stations. We don't have enough stations throughout the state to be able to detect the earthquakes as quickly as we need to. So that's the major technical flaw.
That's why the team's installing as many sensors as they can with the funding they have. Ideally, they want a sensor station every 6 miles in the whole state. That's 600 more than we have right now. Earlier this year, President Trump slashed earthquake early warning funding from the preliminary budget. The House reinstated $10 million, but that will only build a few hundred stations. Before the system goes public, the team needs more long-term funding.
And I hope that this is such a small number that nobody's going to say, oh, we have to remove that again. It's never for sure until the president signs the budget.
To Helweg, it's a no-brainer.
It's relatively inexpensive, and we get a lot of bang for our buck, so to speak. It's a win-win situation. It doesn't matter if you're in a Republican district or a Democrat district. The earthquakes don't care.
Barbara and Howard Hornsby, the couple in the mobile home park in Napa, think so too. Barbara says she carries her cell phone on her all the time, and she knows exactly what she would have done if she got an alert on her phone. She would have stepped away from the bookcase.
2 seconds would get me to a safer place. 8 seconds, I'm sure we could have gotten through the front door.
She says she hopes that when the next big one hits, she'll know it's coming before she feels it. In Napa, for Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
If you've got a story about the environment you'd like to see reported, contact Angela at environment@kalw.org. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Bruce Lee is known around the world for his legendary martial arts, his films, and his TV roles. A new movie, Birth of the Dragon, just opened in the Bay Area. It takes a look at Bruce's early years living in San Francisco in a legendary fight between Lee and Wong Jackman. But there's a lot that this Hollywood version doesn't show. The people who know the behind-the-scenes real hidden stories are Charles Russo, author of the book Striking Distance, Bruce Lee and the Dawn of Martial Arts in America, and Gary Kaganin, an early student at Bruce Lee's school in Oakland. KALW's Ben Trefney sat down to talk with them about Bruce Lee and the birth of the Bay Area's martial arts scene.
So in late 1964, Chinatown got very riled up around the idea that one of their local practitioners was going to go across the bay and fight Bruce Lee at his new school, his new kung fu school in Oakland. Bruce had been upsetting a lot of people in Chinatown based on some of the things that he was saying in his demonstrations. It came to a head, and the day of the fight, six people piled into a car and went over to Oakland. And, you know, what goes down there is really one of sort of the most legendary fights in modern martial arts history.
So, Gary Kaganin, how did you meet Bruce Lee?
To set the record straight, James Lee was my sifu or my instructor. Bruce was the head of the school, but by then he was in Hollywood. I'd met him a couple of times. I never really trained with Bruce, but to train at James's school was a magical period in the history of martial arts. To be able to train at a school that was pretty much Bruce's school, and where he got his fundamental start in Jeet Kune Do, it was amazing, absolutely amazing.
What made it amazing?
The uniqueness of it. It was totally non-traditional. It was oriented towards street fighting, street self-defense. So a lot of the traditional aspects of learning forms and katas and wearing uniforms and things of that nature, we just went in there and learned how to fight.
So Charles, Bruce Lee, there's this interesting connection between San Francisco and Oakland. Could you tell me a little bit about his story and how he got to where he ended up going to Hollywood after running the studio that Gary was part of?
You know, the circumstances of his birth in San Francisco are very interesting. His parents were traveling opera performers with the Cantonese Opera, and they had gotten special visas to come over and perform at a theater in Chinatown. And it was during this time that Bruce was born at the Chinese Hospital on Jackson Street.
So they were only here temporarily.
Yeah, they were here, I believe, for about a year and a half. He goes and grows up in Hong Kong, and while he's there, he gravitates to the martial arts amidst this very tenacious street fighting scene in Hong Kong during the 1950s. His involvement within this culture eventually causes him to get into some trouble as a teenager, and in the spring of 1959, he is sort of abruptly put on a steamship shortly before his high school graduation and sent back.
So he's a late teenager, like 18, 19.
Yeah, he's 18 years old when he returns to San Francisco in the spring of 1959. And he stays briefly with his godfather in Chinatown, where he gives dance lessons. Bruce Lee was, some people know this, Bruce Lee was a champion cha-cha dancer while he was in Hong Kong. So when he comes over to the U.S., he starts giving some lessons. And this is important to understand Bruce's time in the Bay Area and some of the tensions that surface is typically during maybe an intermission, he would give a kung fu demonstration. And at first, they're fairly innocuous. He's just kind of showing off what he could do. But over time, these become sort of critical lectures against the status quo of the martial arts. And as he's airing these opinions in front of different audiences and increasingly qualified martial arts audiences, he starts to develop some tensions with other people within the culture.
Why do you think that is? I mean, he obviously had a respect for martial arts.
Yeah, so Bruce, one of the things I would point out, which one of my, you know, sources explained to me, is when Bruce arrives in 1959, the reputation of the Wing Chun practitioners, Wing Chun being Bruce's original style of Kung Fu, their reputation precedes him to Chinatown. So that rough and tumble street fighting challenge culture, word of that arrives to Chinatown before he does. So he immediately gets off on the wrong foot with them because they instantly perceive him as this sort of upstart troublemaker. And he indeed has some bad interactions early on in 59. And over time, these just continue to, you know, sort of exacerbate one another.
That's Charles Russo, San Francisco journalist and author of Striking Distance, Bruce Lee and the Dawn of Martial Arts in America. So this brings us back to that fight. What ended up happening in this big legendary fight between the upstart Bruce Lee and the representative of the traditionalists, Wong Jackman?
The account that I got from Linda, Bruce's wife, and James Lee was that the fight was pretty simple. It didn't last long, just a couple of minutes at best. And it was one of those things where the people that came along with Wong Jackman wanted to establish rules with respect to this match. And Bruce says, what are you talking about rules? This is a fight, so there are no rules. Let's just fight. They just went at it, and within a short period of time, Bruce is getting the better of him. And the thing is that Bruce was able to get him on the ground and start pounding him and won the fight. It was pretty simple.
And Charles?
There's a ton of controversy surrounding this fight. The debate over this fight rages in chat rooms. You look at any comment board on an article or anything like that, and people are constantly debating exactly what went on.
And it's the subject of this movie,
that's out now,
that may or may not be the way it really happened.
And it very much captures people's imaginations, you know? I mean, the thing that's really amazing about the fight, if you stop and just look at the setup of it, is there's this sort of compelling symmetry between Bruce Lee and Wong Jackman. They're both the same age. They both emerge from the Kung Fu culture of Hong Kong to the Bay Area. And yet they have this sort of yin-yang-like dynamic. Bruce's style is Southern Shaolin, which is compact and close range. Wong Jackman's is Northern Shaolin, which is expansive and long range. They're both the same age. One's from Oakland, one's from San Francisco. And it's just this incredible matchup. And I could see why it captures the popular imagination. What I try to do in the book was go off the accounts of who was in the room. So I try and identify down to an individual who was there and what their accounts were. And every source I talked to, whether they were there or not, had an opinion on it. What I think is interesting is that when you look at Linda's account, and then you match it to, say, one of the people Wong Jackman came over, David Chin, it's very similar. I don't know if it was the most cinematic fight. It was fast and furious and spilled around the room. It culminated in Wong Jackman stumbling to the floor. Bruce very quickly got on top of him and pummeled him and said over and over in Cantonese, do you yield, do you yield? At which point Wong Jackman gave up. With this film right now, you hear a lot of stories about no one knows exactly what happened. The fight might have lasted for 20 minutes. Based on my reporting, I just don't see that. I think they're still dealing in the realm of urban mythology.
That was Charles Russo, author of the book Striking Distance, Bruce Lee and the Dawn of Martial Arts in America, and Gary Kaganen, an early student at Bruce Lee's school in Oakland. They spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney, and you can find an extended version of that conversation at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now let's hear a story from our partners at San Quentin Radio.
San Quentin Radio, bringing you informative educational stories from the inside out.
In order to make something grow, you gotta own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Cause I like to be free, I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop, and all of a sudden you heard this.
Getting a haircut can make a person feel good. For the men in San Quentin, it's no different. Some of the barbers are paid to cut hair. Others volunteer to do it. It can be a complex process, but it's important in the prison environment. Luke Calandres produced this piece inside San Quentin State Prison.
Hi, my name is Bo Gentry. I'm a barber in San Quentin State Prison. I've been a barber for about 35 years in prison.
My name is Rasan Thomas, and I moonlight as a jailhouse barber. I'm not officially assigned. I have my own clippers that I purchased from a package company, and this allows me to go around and cut hair.
My name is Lorenzo Miller, and I'm a barber in North Block. I am assigned. I've been cutting hair for over 35 years.
I enjoy my job. It just relaxes me. I enjoy it. I have fun with it. I'm a very sociable person, so I make people laugh when they sit in my chair, and I pick on everybody, and they all love it. Usually when I'm out there cutting hair, everybody's get a crowd standing around over there watching and talking. And that's how I got a rapport with everybody in my building.
It's fun being there because you hear the important things. You hear a lot of laughter, good stories, funny jokes.
Shower nights are Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. And those are the days that I cut most of the heads that I do. They come up and tell me they need a haircut, and I schedule them right then for that night or the next night or however it works out. I don't cut black hair because if I did, nobody else would come and sit in my chair. That's always been a thing throughout the prison system. When I was on the streets, I cut black hair. I go along with that, and it doesn't cause any problems. We got our black barber in the building. He's a good guy. I've known him for a long, long time, and he's a good barber. He does his thing. And even though I don't cut the brother's hair, they're all my friends too. They cut right next to me. We pick and joke with each other the entire time.
We have four barbers and only three chairs, but we share. When nobody's working, the other one comes in and does his thing.
One of the worst situations that I remember was when I was up in High Desert. I was the barber up there. All of a sudden, somebody started fighting around me. I locked my stuff in my box real quick because it would have got all crazy, right, if they would have got a hold of my tools.
One day, a guy that was going home, he didn't want me to cut his hair. He wanted one of his friends to do it. And that wasn't a good idea because his friend didn't know how to cut. So his friend messed up his hair. And he got so mad that he took the clippers and slammed them on the ground and broke them. And I felt offended because I'm like, you're going home and you broke the clippers. What about us? So I was very disappointed about that. And we ended up fighting behind that. I ended up beating him up before he went home. So I took cutting hair a little bit too seriously back then.
I was at another prison, Ironwood, and I was cutting hair. And somebody distracted me, talking to me. And I forgot I had the 000 on. And I was just gonna clean up his little high top fade he had. And I wasn't paying attention, and I, and he looked at me, and it was like, no. And I said, yeah. And we took it all down. He was mad at me, but he got over it. I just had one that looked like he was riding a motorcycle backwards. His afro was tore up.
I convinced the homeboy that I was a barber, that I really knew what I was doing, and he allowed me to cut his hair. And I had no training at all, and I messed it up. Matter of fact, he wanted a design in the back of his head, and somehow I ended up putting an R. So he was running around with an R, a big giant R in the back of his head, and his name starts with a T. Oops. What you mean, oops? When I first got here, I was cutting a lot of hair. My reputation for a barber has grown. I'm actually pretty good right now, especially when it comes to fades and tapers. I got so overwhelmed with cutting hair. So many friends here, so many people would come to me. And my desire now is to be a writer, so I had to cut them all. They're still mad at me to this day. And there's like 5-10 people that just won't let me not be their barber. They just come everywhere with these. I say, don't come to me, homie, unless it's an emergency. And they have an emergency every week. My mother's coming. She's coming to visit. I swear to God, she's coming Saturday. You got to cut my hair. So I end up cutting more hair than I'm supposed to because I'm supposed to be focusing on my writing. But I do enjoy cutting hair. It's just I like writing more, and I still try to find a way to do both.
There are times that you're just burnt out, you're tired, and they're still coming, you know, because that visit's for the weekend, and you still have to take the time out and say, hey, I got to get you right for your kids, for your wife, for your parents, you know. We want to make sure you're looking nice, you're looking groomed, because we don't need them to think you're stressing out. To me, that's the reward, to see somebody looking real cool.
That piece was produced by Luke Calandris. San Quentin Radio is a project in which KALW editors train inmates to report stories from inside prison. San Quentin officials listen to and approve the script and audio for this story prior to broadcast. Thanks to Sam Robinson and Larry Schneider for their help. The rest of our team today includes China Armstrong, Nina Gensler-Debs, Gabe Graben, Raquel Maria Dillon, Marina Poole, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Corinne Smith. Our show is engineered by James Rollins. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Kugelplex. Kugelplex and Linda Tillery will perform at San Francisco's Yerba Buena Gardens in a free afternoon show on Saturday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.